You're listening to Old Testament Character Podcast 65, the last one in the series, a series where we've covered about 85 characters, maybe a bit more. Well, today I thought we would look at a number of people. You know, it's probably a more generous lesson than most of the ones you've been listening to. Often there's tension between those who are trying to do the right thing and those who are on the wrong side of God's will. I don't think it's possible to live a Christian life, Jesus and the apostles agreed, without being in that state of tension, of being resisted or opposed or even persecuted. And that happens in families, it happens with our mates, our friends from school or work or around town, but especially in the context of families. And so we're going to look at five sets of family members in this talk. We're going to look at one husband and wife, one grandmother and grandson, a father and daughter, and two fathers and sons. Actually, we've already looked at three of these characters in earlier talks, particularly Saul, his son Jonathan, and later King Josiah. And today we'll look at them again, but we'll meet seven or eight further characters, and we'll go chronologically. And first up, it's a father-daughter combination. It's Pharaoh's daughter and Pharaoh. In the book of Exodus, chapter 1, we meet this remarkable woman, the daughter of Pharaoh. Of course, they're both outsiders. They're not of the people of God. They worship multiple gods. And that's good because it's going to remind us that God is at work globally. He's working in all people. And the world of the Old Testament, even the world of the New Testament, it's a fairly small section of the ancient world. But God is everywhere, as the prophet Amos reminds us. Well, let me read in Exodus 1:15. The king of Egypt said to the Hebrew midwives, when you're helping the Hebrew women during childbirth on the delivery stool, if you see a baby as a boy, kill him. If it's a girl, let her live. The midwives, however, feared God and did not do what the king of Egypt had told them to do. They let the boys live. Yeah, I can't resist making the comment. So many places in the Old Testament, women are heroic. They really step up and do things that the men should have done. A few verses later, Pharaoh does not want to be frustrated, so he gives this order to all the people. Every Hebrew boy that is born, you must throw into the Nile, but let every girl live. So he decrees drowning. And this is in a context some of us may relate to it in our own countries. There were a lot of foreigners because the Hebrews, they're not Egyptians, and they're multiplying. And when the foreign population, immigrant population gets large, that can cause all kinds of tension. We have xenophobia. And I think Pharaoh was playing on that. But the people of God don't want to go along with this, obviously, because his policy would jeopardize their future. And then we come to chapter 2, where we meet, soon we'll meet Pharaoh's daughter. Not yet. Now, a man of the tribe of Levi married a Levite woman. And she became pregnant and gave birth to a son. And when she saw he was a fine child, she hid him for 3 months. But when she could hide him no longer, she got a papyrus basket for him and coated it with tar and pitch. And by the way, that's exactly the same word as ark, as in Noah's ark. And I think it's deliberately so. Because the future of God's people, it's in that little ark, that little arklet. Then she placed the child in it, put it among the reeds along the bank of the Nile. And his sister stood at a distance to see what would happen to him. Well, we know the story. The baby is Moses. His mother concealed him as long as she possibly could, and he became too big or too loud, or it was too obvious. And she doesn't throw him in the Nile. She actually puts him in a vessel and doesn't put it in the middle of the stream, puts it at the riverbank. And his sister is monitoring. Miriam is standing by. So the question is, who will rescue him? What will divine rescue look like? Who will the Lord use to save this innocent baby of the highest pedigree? Well, Miriam's watching, and so are we. We want to know how things will turn out. And the hero turns out to be a pagan, a worshiper of the Egyptian gods. In 2:5, Pharaoh's daughter went down to the Nile to bathe. And her attendants were walking along the riverbank. She saw the basket among the reeds and sent her female slave to get it. She opened it and saw the baby. He was crying and she felt sorry for him. "This is one of the Hebrew babies," she said. Then his sister asked Pharaoh's daughter, Shall I go and get one of the Hebrew women to nurse the baby for you? Yes, go, she answered. It's, you know, it's amazing because basically she just gets its mother. So that's great. And Moses' mother was even paid. So she was, he was better off. She was better off because of Pharaoh's daughter. And the child grows older and she takes him to Pharaoh's daughter and he became her son. So he's officially adopted into the royal family. Oh, and she named him Moses, saying, I drew him out of the water. Okay. We're not told whether she ever told her father, the Pharaoh, that she had adopted a Hebrew baby. Maybe he knew, maybe he didn't. We're given no details about her interactions with her father, who just happens to be the Pharaoh. Besides, pharaohs had lots of wives and children. Most scholars think the Pharaoh of the Exodus would be Ramses II. He was a Pharaoh who reigned something like 70 years. He lived to be 90-something, and he had 50 sons and 50 daughters, approximately. I do remember when he turned, I think it was his 12th birthday or 13th, his father gave him a present. It was a harem of 100 girls. So who knows how many children he had. One more maybe wasn't that significant, though it would be. And it's interesting because even Pharaoh was considered divine. He is the very representation of Ra, you know, the sun god on the earth. And yet, in the story, he's mocked. He's mocked not by verbal scorn, but by what God was doing in the simple heart of this young woman, a woman who moved at cross purposes to her father. Even though she was not of God's people, God used Pharaoh's own daughter with her compassion to basically ensure the future of his people. Now, perhaps her adoption of Moses was more natural affection than virtue. I don't know how to calculate that. And again, it's possible that she was unaware of Pharaoh's decree, as was Jonathan, as we'll see in our very next section. Okay, so that's our first character. Second, we're going to look at Jonathan and Saul. Pharaoh's daughter, that's going back to the 14th century BC. And now we're in the 11th century. The centuries are flying. We meet Jonathan, who is a really likable fellow. He's humble before God and others, and he's clearly brave and faithful. He's not just a godless soldier like Joab, who will later be David's chief general. He's a man of faith, and we see this in 1 Samuel 13 and 14. I'd like to read a little bit in chapter 14. Now, the Israelites were in distress because Saul had bound the people under an oath, saying, "Cursed be anyone who eats food before evening comes, before I have avenged myself on my enemies." So none of the troops tasted food. Now, we have to admit, this is quite an odd strategy. You want your army to be strong, and it decides they won't eat. And his real purpose, he tells them, it's he wants revenge himself. It's kind of about him. It wasn't very smart. Well, the entire army entered the woods, and there was honey on the ground. And when they went into the woods, they saw the honey oozing out. Yet no one put his hand to his mouth because they feared the oath. But Jonathan had not heard that his father had bound the people with an oath. So he reached out the end of his staff that was in his hand, and he dipped it into the honeycomb. He raised his hand to his mouth. His eyes brightened. Of course, he had the sugar rush. And then one of the soldiers told him, "Your father bound the army under a strict oath, saying, 'Cursed be anyone who eats food today.' That's why the men are faint." Jonathan sees right through his father's foolish rule. Again, he's the father. Saul is the father of Jonathan. Saul is the first king of Israel. Jonathan sees through it, that it's counterproductive. And of course, Saul had apparently not informed his own son that he would be cursed if he ate honey. And it continues with basically Saul saying, "Okay, sorry, Jonathan, I have to kill you." But the people standing around will not let that happen because Jonathan's a good guy. Jonathan says, "My father has made trouble for the country. See how my eyes brightened when I tasted a little of this honey. How much better it would have been if the men had eaten today some of the plunder they took from their enemies. Wouldn't the slaughter of the Philistines have been even greater?" See, Jonathan's able to see the big picture. Now, he has the quality of loyalty, but not stupidity. And this is a great quality of Jonathan. And it stands in stark contrast to his father's demeanor when it comes to loyalty and consistency, being a man of your word, and spirituality. We go to 1 Samuel 18. After David had finished talking with Saul, Jonathan became one in spirit with David, and he loved him as himself. And Jonathan made a covenant with David because he loved him as himself. Jonathan took off the robe he was wearing, gave it to David along with his tunic, and even his sword, his bow, and his belt. He has a capacity for friendship so different to his father. And David feels very close to Jonathan. They encourage each other. And I say that not only from the next couple of passages we'll read, but after Jonathan dies, in 2 Samuel 1, we see David's words, the funeral song, and obviously they were very close. For Samuel 19:1, Saul told his son Jonathan and all the attendants to kill David. But Jonathan had taken a great liking to David. Jonathan spoke well of him to Saul, his father. Let not the king do wrong to his servant David. He has not wronged you, and what he has done has benefited you greatly. Saul listened to Jonathan and took this oath. As surely as the Lord lives, David will not be put to death. But of course, Saul goes back on it. So Jonathan defends his friends, even when it's politically not expedient. But this is this incredible irony. He's best friends with David, and Saul has decided that David is his mortal enemy. That put Jonathan in a very difficult bind. After a very painful occasion, we find later in 1 Samuel, Saul's son Jonathan went to David at Horesh and helped him find strength in God. "Don't be afraid," he said. "My father Saul will not lay a hand on you. You will be king over Israel, and I will be second to you. Even my father Saul knows this." The two of them made a covenant before the Lord. And then Jonathan went home, but David remained at Horesh. We see that spiritual relationship, the humility. Jonathan didn't really care who was king over Israel. He's happy for his friend to be the king and to be his lieutenant, his deputy, his right hand. And yet again, Jonathan is at total cross purposes with Saul. Saul's trying to get rid of David. Jonathan wants to lift him up. Saul wants to tear him down. Jonathan never did become king or even live that long to enjoy his relationship with David through the decades. But like his father and his brothers, he dies in battle against the Philistines. That's at the end of 1 Samuel. Now, our next character becomes king, but only after a period of hiding. In fact, for many years, he's a boy king. His name is Joash. It's the 8th century BC, and we want to learn about Joash and his grandmother, Athaliah. Joash had lost his father, Ahaziah. He was assassinated by Jehu, the zealous driver, the zealous Israelite. And while his siblings were being executed by his power-greedy grandmother, Joash's half-sister hides him until the strategic time. Now, I've had the privilege of knowing both of my grandmothers. They've passed on quite some time ago, but they were good people. Athaliah, Joash's grandmother, and she's not sweet. She's not a sweet little old lady. She's vicious. Let's read. Jehosheba, the daughter of Joram, King Joram, took Joash, son of Ahaziah, and stole him away from among the royal princes who were about to be murdered, and put him and his nurse in a bedroom. Because Jehosheba, the daughter of King Joram and wife of the priest Jehoiada, was Ahaziah's sister, she hid the child from Athaliah so she couldn't kill him. He remained hidden with them at the temple of God for 6 years while Athaliah ruled the land. That's in 2 Chronicles 22. 11 and 12. Okay, it's a lot of names. There are only three we should know. Joash is the boy. His siblings are all killed, but his grandmother is not a godly person. That's Athaliah. And then there's Jehoiada, and that's a priest who is a good guy. And they make sure that Joash is concealed. It actually says he was hidden at the temple. You might wonder, well, how can you hide there? Well, the temple had all kinds of storage rooms along the sides, and I imagine it was in one of those rooms where he was hidden for years, right under the nose of the ruling, the regent Ataliah. So his grandmother is ruling the land. And she's wicked. She's a strong leader, but a wicked woman. So she grabs control of Judah and rules it for 6 years. Now, Jehoiada is the elderly guardian of Joash. And he knew that Joash's grandmother was ruining the nation and would just make it worse. And Jehoiada had the nerve to depose her once the time was right. And then now we read an account of one of the many coup d'etat of the Bible. In the seventh year, Jehoiada showed his strength. Now that's the guardian, that's the older man. Joash, he's just in his 12th or 13th year now. Jehoiada made a covenant with the commanders. The whole assembly made a covenant with the king at the temple of God. Jehoiada said to them, "The king's son shall reign as the Lord promised concerning the descendants of David." And by the way, that is correct, because from David, it was meant to be one single dynasty. Even Jesus is descended from David. All the kings of Judah are sons, grandsons of David. Jehoiada stationed all the men, each with his weapon in his hand, around the king, near the altar and the temple, from the south side to the north side of the temple. Jehoiada and his sons brought out the king's son and put the crown on him. They presented him with a copy of the covenant and proclaimed him king. They anointed him and shouted, "Long live the king!" What about Ataliah? Well, she heard the noise of the people running and cheering the king, and she went to them at the temple, and she looked, and there's the king standing by his pillar at the entrance. Oh, she knows this is not good. The officers and the trumpeters were beside the king, and all the people of the land were rejoicing and blowing trumpets, and singers with musical instruments were leading the praises. Not Ataliah, no. She tears her robes and shouts, "Treason! Treason!" And Jehoiada the priest sent out the commanders of units of 100 in charge of the troops and said to them, "Bring her out between the ranks and put to the sword anyone who follows her." The priest had said, "Do not put her to death at the temple of the Lord." So they seized her as she reached the entrance on the horse gate of the palace grounds, and they put her to death. Okay, it's grisly here. The Jehoiada then makes a covenant that he and all the people will be the Lord's people. And basically, they go to the temple of Baal, they tear that down, they smash the altars, they dispatch the priest of Baal, they put oversight of the temple in the hands of the Levites, the ones who should be doing the work. They really try to clean things up, and there's rejoicing. And the king, Joash, is brought down, and they go into the palace, and the king sits down on the royal throne, and everyone rejoices, and the city was quiet because Ataliah had been slain with the sword. That's in 2 Chronicles 23. Well, we have to fast forward, though. You know, Joash was 7 when he became king. He rules for 40 years, but the early Joash is not the same man as the later Joash. Joash did what was right in the eyes of the Lord all the years of Jehoiada the priest. But once Jehoiada is out of the picture, Joash regresses. I mean, he's doing well for a while. He even restores the lapsed temple. In fact, at one point, Joash even challenges his guardian, Jehoiada, to expect more of the leaders, the priests and Levites. You know, so far, so good. It looks good. That's why I'm saying it's a different guy. We read this. As long as Jehoiada lived, burnt offerings were presented continually in the temple of the Lord. Now Jehoiada was old and full of years, and he died at the age of 130. He was buried with the kings in the city of David because of the good he had done in Israel for God and his temple. After the death of Jehoiada, the officials of Judah came and paid homage to the king, and he listened to them. And they abandoned the temple of the Lord, the God of the fathers, and worshipped Asherah poles and idols. And because of their guilt, God's anger came upon Judah and Jerusalem. I'm going to simplify the story here a bit, but God sends prophets to give the people and to give Joash a chance to repent, but Joash won't take input, and he has the prophet killed. This is a prophet named Zechariah, which is crazy because he was actually Jehoiada's son. I mean, he was alive because of Jehoiada, and this is how he repays Jehoiada after he dies, you know, by killing his son. Well, this spiritual influence no longer shapes Joash once Jehoiada's out of the picture. The boy king quickly declines, and we see he really does lack character. Really lacks character. And at the turn of the year, the army of Aram, that's Syria, the perennial enemy of Israel, march against Joash. Now, although the Aramean army had come with only a few men, Yahweh delivered into their hands a much larger army. Because Judah had forsaken the Lord, the God of their fathers, judgment was executed on Joash. You know, Joash has a good-sized army. This little army comes against him, but he's not right with the Lord. The Lord's not going to support him. When the Arameans withdrew, they left Joash severely wounded. And then it says his officials conspired against him for murdering the son of Jehoiada the priest, and they killed him in his bed. So he died and was buried in the city of David, but not in the tombs of the kings. Wow, he starts out so well. He takes a stand. He's exemplary. But he ends up beaten in battle, even though his forces far outnumbered the enemy. That's not a good ending, but it's what happens. When we turn from God, despite the sustained positive spiritual influence of his guardian Jehoiada over many years, Joash as an adult forsook the Lord. And that seems to be an exception to the general truth of Proverbs 22:6. He was trained in the way he should go, but he wandered away. The influence of parents and authority figures does not work mechanically or fatalistically. Everyone has a choice. Anyway, we see that Joash was at cross purposes with his grandmother. Sadly, later, he's at cross purposes with Jehoiada once Jehoiada dies, and he's at cross purposes with God. And like many of us, his life, it's a blend of the wonderful and the tragic, faith and lack of faith. But his story is over. It's finished. Yours and mine is still being written. Well, Joash went from good to bad. Fortunately, our next fellow goes the opposite direction, and that's King Josiah. And we'll look at the relationship of Josiah, as much as we can, to his father Ammon. This is the 7th century BC. Ammon was a wicked king, really bad. Now, his father was Manasseh, who was king for 55 years, is a terrible king, terrible. Although in his final years, he does right and he turns to God, but Ammon's terrible. I mean, who names his son after an Egyptian god? Anyway, Josiah is the king of Judah through whom Yahweh offered his people one last chance to get right with him, to be saved from Babylon. Because already the northern kingdom has been taken into captivity by the Assyrians. And now the Babylonians are knocking on the door. I'm in 2 Kings 21. Ammon was 22 years old when he became king, and he reigned in Jerusalem 2 years. His mother's name was Meshulamet, daughter of Haruz. She was from Jotba. He did evil in the eyes of the Lord, as his father Manasseh had done. He followed completely the ways of his father, worshiping the idols his father had worshipped, bowing down to them. He forsook the Lord, the God of his ancestors, and did not walk in obedience to him. Ammon's officials conspired against him and assassinated the king in his palace. Then the people of the land killed all who had plotted against King Ammon, and they made Josiah, his son, king in his place. Well, that's Ammon, a wicked king. He was brought up in a very wicked way by Manasseh, and Manasseh was king for so long, by the time Manasseh died, Ammon is, he's not going to change. Josiah's father was a wicked, ungodly man, but that doesn't mean Josiah is going to be that way. Now we're in 2 Kings 22, verse 1. Josiah was 8 years old when he became king, and he reigned in Jerusalem 31 years. His mother's name was Jedidiah, etc. He did what was right in the eyes of the Lord and followed completely the ways of his father David, not turning aside to the right or to the left. So Josiah is just the opposite of Ammon. Certainly he did not live up to his father's expectations. It's kind of like someone saying he or she wants to enter the full-time paid Christian ministry. I want to be on staff, or I want to be a missionary. Many of us are familiar with the disappointment or disapproval of parents, or even shame among family members when we take a step of faith to live for the Lord. People can be embarrassed when their daughter or son becomes not a lawyer or a doctor, but wants to become a minister. He didn't live up to his father's expectations. Some of you know what I'm talking about here. Ammon is the opposite of the later Manasseh, that is the grandfather of Josiah. And Josiah, of course, the opposite of Ammon. They're at cross purposes. And then the long-lost book of the law is discovered. This story is a marvelous story told several times in the Bible. And let me just give a little bit. This will be from the end of the story. The king heard the words of the book of the law, and he tore his robes. And he says, go inquire of the Lord for me and for the people and for all Judah about what is written in this book that's been found. Great is the Lord's anger that burns against us, because those who have gone before us have not obeyed the words of this book. They've not acted in accordance with all written there concerning us. Well, what Josiah does, and I mentioned this in an earlier podcast on the prophetess Huldah, Josiah says, we need to inquire of the Lord. And so they go to a prophet. Well, prophetess, because it's a female prophet. God works through women as easily as through men. And she gives a very strong message, and Josiah takes it to heart. The king called together all the elders of Judah and Jerusalem. He went up to the temple of the Lord with the people of Judah, the inhabitants of Jerusalem, the priests and the prophets, all the people from the least to the greatest. He read in their hearing all the words of the book of the covenant which had been found in the temple of the Lord. So Josiah honors the word of God. He renews the covenant. Remember, Jehoiada did something like that too. And things seem to be going well for Jerusalem. The king stood by the pillar and renewed the covenant, the presence of the Lord, to follow the Lord and keep his commands, statutes, and decrees with all his heart, all his soul, thus confirming the words of the covenant written in this book. And then all the people pledged themselves to the covenant. But you know, Josiah's reformation didn't last very long. It was really a case of too little, too late. The kings of Judah before him had not been good kings. He was an exception himself, and Jerusalem would stand only for another 30 plus years. This is 621 BC. The temple is destroyed in 587 with the Babylonians. And certainly Josiah was rowing against the tide, because most of the leaders and people of Judah were at cross purposes with Yahweh. Well, the final people we look at, two monarchs, they're not in the land of Israel. As with Pharaoh and his daughter, they're outside, and not in Egypt, but in Persia. The Persians at this time worship Ahura Mazda. They follow a religion called Zoroastrianism. This is more than 1,000 years before Islam, before that would make the country become the Islamic Republic of Iran. So these monarchs are, well, Xerxes is extremely well known in history, but his wife is named Vashti. So 5th century BC, Vashti really only appears for a few verses, but it's enough for us to work with. I'm reading from Esther 1, verse 1. This is what happened during the time of Xerxes. The Xerxes, who ruled over 127 provinces, stretching from India to Kush, that's East Africa. At that time, King Xerxes reigned from his royal throne in the citadel of Susa. And in the third year of his reign, he gave a banquet for all his nobles and officials, the military leaders of Persia and Media, the princes, and the nobles of the provinces were present. So it's this huge display. By the way, it says Media, the leaders of Media were there, not the Media were there, though probably the Media were there too. But the Medians were, Media was a country that aligned itself with Persia. So Xerxes the king up till 465 BC, his dominion is a big territory. It's huge. And it's not just that's huge. This banquet is a big deal. Xerxes is really counting on this to augment his reputation, to bring glory and honor and you know, show people how powerful he is. But this is a familiar scenario in the Bible. This goes all the way back to the book of Genesis. Think of what happened in Babel or on the plain of Shinar. They build the Tower of Babel. God's not impressed with that. He's not impressed with our showiness. God is the only real sovereign. But we read a little bit more about this banquet. For a full 180 days, he displayed the vast wealth of his kingdom and the splendor and glory of his majesty. When these days were over, the king gave a banquet lasting 7 days in the enclosed garden of the king's palace. For all the people, from the least to the greatest, who were in the citadel of Susa, and it goes on describing this opulent occasion with a flowing wine. I mean, it's a long feast. And even Queen Vashti gives a banquet as well for the women in the royal palace. On the seventh day, that is the last day of this banquet, When King Xerxes was in high spirits from wine, he commanded the 7 eunuchs who served him to bring before him Queen Vashti, wearing her royal crown, in order to display her beauty to peoples and nobles, for she was lovely to look at. Now, remember, Xerxes is inebriated. He wants Queen Vashti to come and display her beauty, wearing her royal crown. Some people think he wanted her wearing only her royal crown. But whether clothed or not, she refuses to be gawked at. She's not going to do it. We read, when the attendants delivered the king's command, Queen Vashti refused to come. Well, good for her. But the king of Persia is made to look foolish, not just here in chapter 1, but throughout the book of Esther. Xerxes is shown to be a fool. He gives orders that he cannot countermand. He's trapped by this culture and legal system that often doesn't even make sense. And right under his nose, people get away with defying him. It actually connects him to Pharaoh. He also had these silly laws, and they're flouted right under his nose. Anyway, Xerxes is furious, burns with anger. According to law, what must be done to Queen Vashti, he asked. She has not obeyed the command of King Xerxes that the eunuchs have taken to her. And then Memucan replies in the presence of the king and nobles. Queen Vashti has done wrong, not only against the king, but against all the nobles and peoples of all the provinces of King Xerxes. You know, I'm thinking to myself, wow, she's offended against all 127 provinces, satrapies. Everyone's been wronged by Vashti. Oh, wow. For the queen's conduct will become known to all the women, and they will despise their husbands and say, King Xerxes commanded Queen Vashti to be brought before him, and she wouldn't come. Can you see what a little man this king is? Look at the way he reacts. Therefore, his advisor says, if it pleases the king, let him issue a royal decree. Let it be written in the laws of the Persian media, which cannot be repealed, that Vashti is never again to enter the presence of King Xerxes. And also let the king give her royal position to someone else who's better than she is. Esther 2:1. Later, when King Xerxes' fury had subsided, he remembered Vashti and what he had done and what he had decreed about her. I think what it's saying is that when the wine wore off, he realized that probably wasn't the best call. He had definitely shown poor judgment, and there may just be a hint of regret in that last verse I read. And like that other Gentile king, Pharaoh, his projection of hubris and, well, perfection is shown to be empty. The other three monarchs, Saul, Attalai, and Amon, that we looked at, are also shown to be not just ungodly, but sham leaders. It's just fake. It's pseudo. Well, what happens? Vashti is replaced. In Esther 2:4, let the young woman who pleased the king be queen instead of Vashti. The advice appealed to the king, and he followed it. And then we read that the king was attracted to Esther more than to any of the other women. So we've not even got into the main characters of Mordecai and Esther, but that's all we need, because I wanted us to think about Vashti and her husband. Sometimes a husband may make an unreasonable request. Vashti did no wrong. Xerxes was the one in the wrong here, and he was on the wrong side of God, of righteousness. He's at cross purposes. Well, what does this all mean for us? Well, I wanted to do this because sometimes we find ourselves at cross purposes. Hopefully not with God, but haven't you had run-ins and tension with people who just don't understand the commitment involved in being a Christian? They don't understand the way you spend your time, the way you spend your money. And that can especially be the case with family members, as we saw with Pharaoh's daughter, Jonathan, Joash, Josiah, and Vashti. So, you know, I call this lesson Old Testament characters at cross purposes. My first title was Royalty Misbehaving, because these are all royals. The question really is, how should we interact with those close to us, people involved in our lives, family, maybe not family, when there are conflicting agendas? You know, we need to respect everyone, always. We want to please them, obey them perhaps, usually. Ignore them, though, if they're pushing us to go against God's will. We cannot live for the approval of the world or of worldly people. We're to take our stand with the people of God. And all these stories remind us of that fact. We're to take our stand with God's people, knowing that ultimately His will be done. And may the Lord strengthen our resolve to live this way. I really hope that our lives, yours and mine, are not at cross purposes with God. What is our agenda? What are we working for? We saw a number of clashes in our study this evening. I hope that will remind us that these lessons are for us. There is so much to learn. If you've enjoyed the Old Testament Character Podcast series, there's also a New Testament series, and that's about 70 talks covering 90 characters. Now, there are many ways to study God's Word. We can study the Bible chapter by chapter, or we can trace themes and topics, or we can study characters. But please don't stop with only 175 that we give attention to in these two series, because there are hundreds of biblical characters, after all, and they're really worth studying. God bless you. Thank you for taking time to listen to these lessons.